Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 134 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. The time period that we're living through today is frequently called the Information Age, and it's true that we're now capable of distributing and accessing more information than at any other point in human history. This podcast is a case in point. But we aren't the first human beings to be interested in collecting and sharing information, of course. Many medieval people were hugely invested in finding ways to organize and share what they knew, too, including an influential translator from Gloucestershire, John Trevisa. This week, I invited Dr. Emily Steiner to speak with me about John Trevisa's work as a translator and influencer in the 14th century. In addition to her work co-editing books of essays, Emily is the author of several books, including Documentary Culture and the Making of Medieval English Literature and Reading Piers Plowman. Her new book is John Trevisa's Information Age, Knowledge and the Pursuit of Literature, circa 1400. Here's our conversation about medieval compendia, how medieval encyclopedias differ from modern ones, and how John Trevisa specifically was an important influence on both information and the English language. Well, thank you, Emily, for joining me to talk about John Trevisa's Information Age. It's such a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So this is one of these books that I imagine might have been a hard sell at first because you're mostly talking about medieval compendia, and that's not something people think of as necessarily an exciting topic, perhaps. So can you tell us about compendia and why you thought they were interesting enough to write a whole book about?
Yes, that's a very good question. I'm really drawn to texts that other people think might be boring or too long or inaccessible. I'm really drawn to allegorical dream vision, the bigger the better. I'd already written a book on Piers Plowman. So I'm not very easily daunted by big off-putting texts. And I think that if we really want to understand what medieval readers treasured, really kind of literally like put their money into, then we're also going to embrace big reference books, which I just call as a shorthand compendia or encyclopedias, books that try to bring a lot of different information into one place in like a short form for short entries for each thing. And there's lots of these. So yes, it was a little bit of a hard sell, but I really felt from the very beginning this really strong sense that if I could make people love these hard to love, hard to edit texts, that they would gain a lot from it. So I definitely felt like from the beginning that this made a lot of sense as a project.
Well, the book has come together beautifully. Like, it's so insightful and so sensitive. Like, I'm wary of using that word, you know, when we're speaking to like female scholars, that it might be too gendered, but it's very, the way that you read this, especially the Polychronicon, which you spend a lot of time on, which we'll get to. But the way you read it is very intuitive, very sensitive, and you pick up on so many amazing cues. So I think that you've sold compendia very well here. Okay, so compendia are kind of like encyclopedias, but how are they different from modern encyclopedias or the way that we arrange information in the modern world?
Okay, I think there are some very serious commonalities. And I think that although encyclopedia is a post-medieval word, in the way that I'm using it, it's not really a post-medieval concept. There's definitely a through line from Wikipedia to early modern encyclopedias to medieval encyclopedias in the way that they organize information and differentiate between different topics and species. I think probably the really big difference is that both modern and medieval encyclopedias, big reference books, make you feel like you are could possibly learn everything from them, that they actually contain everything. So they both have that kind of fiction. I think that very generally, the post-medieval encyclopedia, the modern encyclopedia, actually wants to deliver on that promise. Like it would like to give you optimally a little bit of everything, and that everything is knowable eventually. Where with medieval encyclopedias, that is not the case. They're happy to leave things out and they're happy to make things up. Because the idea behind the medieval encyclopedia is that there's a created universe and that the creator has the potential to have made or to make anything way outside of human knowledge. And so to know some of that is great. And to come up with a mythological hybrid beast along with things that you absolutely know about is okay too, because who could doubt that God could make anything that God wanted to make? Mermaids, Amazons, everybody's in there, but also unbelievable details about like migraines and how you get them, because there's things we know and there's things we don't know. And we don't have to know everything in order to appreciate the possibilities of what could be in there, what could be known.
Absolutely. And it's funny how you see these evolve and everyone who copies it, translates it. We're going to get to John Trevisa in a second. Everyone who translates it puts their own stamp on it, puts their own mark on it. And I think that perhaps today we like to think of encyclopedias as being objective, which they can't possibly be. But no one was really concerned about that in the Middle Ages, were they?
They're not. I mean, they're concerned about citing authorities, but the authorities are also being collected and also sometimes invented or anonymous or misattributed. So no, I think there's a lot more imaginative space. I wouldn't say so much they're subjective where modern encyclopedias are objective, because as you just said, there's a lot of subjectiveness in modern encyclopedias. But I would say that medieval encyclopedias tend to embrace more of an imaginative field of knowledge and incorporated it into what is observable and known.
So we get into John Trevisa's prose a lot in your book. So it's probably a good moment to say, who is John Trevisa and why is he important?
And scholars have known about John Trevisa for a long time. You know, he's not like a mystery man. One of the things that I noticed about John Trevisa, which is also true for the Wycliffe Bible, is that he's incredibly oversighted in the Middle English Dictionary. So like far out of proportion to the way that he should be cited. I mean, that's partly because he wrote so many words and a lot of those words are translations of Latin words. So they make sense to be included in a dictionary. John Trevisa was a scholar at Oxford, kind of a lifelong scholar at Oxford, at Exeter and at Queen's College, Oxford. But he, like a lot of his contemporaries at Queen's College, Oxford, like John Wycliffe or Nicholas Hereford, John Purvey, like he was really interested in finding a patron. And he did. And he totally scored. And he got this amazing patron, Thomas de Berkeley, who was a very wealthy baron who was interested in culture, who had a seat in Gloucestershire and sponsored him. And he seems to have been in his entourage as a clerk, as a priest, and continued with his studies as kind of like a lifelong learner, if you want. And the two of them seem to have in some ways collaborated as patron and scholar on translating these absolutely gigantic works, which in the book, I argue that, and it's speculative, but I speculate that they were very consciously trying to create a court of letters in the improbable place of Berkeley Castle, Gloucestershire.
So what do you mean by a court of letters? Because this is something that you get into quite deeply in the book, as you're saying, as the motive behind what John Trevisa is doing.
Yeah, I mean, so these are really big, expensive, beautiful manuscripts that Trevisa and Berkeley are producing at the end of the 14th century and the beginning of the 15th century. So they're luxury manuscripts, kind of creating more than one compendious text is sort of luxurious by definition for medieval manuscript culture. They're staggeringly large and heavy. And the topics that they chose, universal history, a giant natural encyclopedia, advice to princes, that's De Regimenem Principum. These are the kinds of texts that were also being produced a generation or half generation earlier at the court of Charles V of France, who was a very important collector of books and patron of the arts and patron of book arts, and someone who patronized a lot of different kinds of genres, but was particularly interested in the translation of informational texts. And so there's a lot of evidence for me to suggest that Trevise and Berkeley were in a more modest but still ambitious way trying to bring that tradition to England and to English letters.
What I think is interesting about what you're saying is that these are luxury manuscripts, as you say, because it takes a lot of sheep to make an encyclopedia. But they're also really well illustrated. They're beautiful manuscripts. And what's interesting about this is one of Trevisa's prefaces, I think it's a preface, is this dialogue between a lord and a clerk, which is probably based on him speaking with his lord. And one of the arguments that's made in it is that information should be for everybody. And yet these are luxury manuscripts. So how does that work together?
Right. That's a good question. Well, there's sort of two ways to think about it. When they say information is for everybody, they mean that information is for lay people and for clerics in the entourage of lay people who are ministering to wealthy lay people. But there is an important extension in that idea from Latin to vernacular, from academia to the secular court. So even though you might argue that this is not exactly Wikipedia, it's not even the Encyclopedia Britannica in its pre-online form. It's still a gesture out. And it supposes a different kind of audience with different needs, audiences that have needs, that are interested in local things, that are might be interested in their own country, that might be interested in things pertaining to the body, marriage, in ways that are different from a clerical academic audience. So once you decide that you're going to create a book of knowledge for lay people, even really wealthy lay people, you're still like moving the dial. Like you're sort of laying the groundwork for a field of general knowledge that could potentially include a lot more literate people or people with access to literacy.
Yeah. And what I liked about your analysis of this dialogue was that it's framed in kind of a way that indicates that this is the Lord's responsibility, because the Lord is in charge of everyone's welfare. And one of his jobs is to make sure that people have information. I think this is a really interesting point that you make there that might have been subtle in some ways, perhaps for people who are reading this and are like, this is a dry book. It's a very subtle insight that you make here.
Yeah, I think that in that prologue, which a lot of people have thought about because it's so intriguing and it's clearly meant to be a prologue to this giant universal, English universal history. In that prologue, Trevisa seizes on this idea of need and that information is somehow needful. Food and drink are needful. God is needful. But information is also needful. And why is information needful? It's a question that we have too. Like, why do we need to know things? We need to know things sometimes in very obvious ways. Like we need to know that there's a certain kind of antidote to poison.
yes.
But why do we need to know about dinosaurs or like how many planets are there in the solar system? And there are certain things today that we would find really strange if a child didn't know.
Yeah.
Like, had never heard of dinosaurs. We know that most seven-year-olds are deeply interested in dinosaurs, and we think they should have those books. We think they should know how many planets there are. There's a lot of things like that that we've come to decide are needful, even though they don't have direct application. And the reason I'm just harping on this is because I feel like the seeds of that are sort of planted in the 14th century.
So one of the things I think that you make as a really interesting point about this dissemination of knowledge and this discussion that's between the Lord and the clerk is that you think that you have some suspicions that this might be kind of practice. So what do you think it might be practicing for in terms of argument? Translation is important because.
I think that prologue, the dialogue between a Lord and a clerk, is modeling a kind of lay education. It's laying the groundwork for interlocution for lay people, how they might go about arguing with a cleric in their entourage, almost like a script, but also where they can participate in the sort of traditional Q&A that's such a crucial part of medieval learning and classical learning.
Yeah. And this is important in the 1370s because there's a lot of agitation about what should be translated, especially when it comes to the Bible, biblical texts. So how does this work, do you think, as kind of a preview for arguments you could make for a biblical translation?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I was curious about is why are they making these arguments, which seem to be about biblical translation, but making them about a universal history? Treviso was a colleague of Wycliffe's. So some reformers would attribute the translation of the Bible in part to Treviso. Whether that's true or not, you know, we don't really know. But I think that there's a lot of different ways to see it. I mean, one way is that Treviso is trying out arguments that could be deployed for biblical translation and trying them out in like a safer place, talking about a universal history. It could also be that Treviso saw the universal history as a kind of Bible, as a kind of extension of biblical information. Other people have made that argument too. I think that's absolutely plausible. I think that he recognized that history was something that you could argue about, especially as it applies to you. And as you read through his universal history called the Polychronicon, Treviso inserts a lot of notes. And a lot of them are very agitated sounding and doubtful and skeptical, especially when it comes to like monastic history or about the lessons that you're, he's kind of like a misreader of monastic history and like takes the wrong lessons deliberately. So I think he's also suggesting that history itself, historical writing itself, is something that's at once deeply needful, it's deeply needed, and it's also a place of contention where you can take different things from it, which, you know, was clever and interesting. And he probably couldn't have gotten to that place if he didn't have a lay patron in his sights.
Yes, absolutely. This isn't the type of thing you want to take on, especially because the Polychronicon, which he's translating, was already super popular. So if you're going to go in there and start arguing with it, it's good to have someone at your back.
Absolutely.
So the Polychronicon in its form that Treviso's inheriting, it's a monastic chronicle, so it has a monastic flavor to it. And Treviso's writing against this. And what I think is really interesting about this is the Polychronicon in its earlier form, it does have a little bit of attribution. So this is written by me, you know, Ranulf. But Treviso even takes that a bit further. So he doesn't leave any doubt as to who's doing this translation. So why do you think this is happening where he's making sure that everyone knows this is his input? Because in previous centuries, so much has been anonymous. Why does he all of a sudden need to make this about him?
That's a good question. I mean, Ranulf Higdon is also very interested in making about him. Mm-hmm. He really tried to exert a lot of control over this text. And in one intermediate version that's in the Huntington Library, we really see him display all his cards and show us how he did that, how he exerted control over it, supplying a index and comments and his name. And, you know, we see how he went about trying to keep control over that text. So Treviso has an exemplar of how to do that. I think part of the reason that he wants to do that is that I think he sees himself and his own translation and his own life and his own experience as part of the now of historical writing. And I think that in itself is maybe kind of an innovation to say, that was then, this is now, I'm in the now, I'm the commentator. You know what I mean? So it's not simply like, I'm an authority, like you're an authority. It's more like, I'm the continuation of the story.
Yeah, I like
my
that.
Subject position.
Well, yeah, and it's positioning it in time and space in ways that you get at in the book too, where he's like, I've seen this happen. I think it's talking about differences in human physiology. And he's saying, I've seen this happen where I live, and here's where I live, and here's who I am.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point for me, in which Ranulf Higdon is talking about different anomalous bodies. And this is medieval writers talking about bodies that are anomalous, or human races that have something peculiar, is a very old tradition. You see it in the monstrous races literature in Old English. You see it in Augustine's City of God. You see it in Pliny. So when writers try to talk about different monstrous races or anomalous individuals, they're really showing off the kind of knowledge that they have. But Trevisa does this very strange thing where he's like, well, near Berkeley Castle, there was actually a guy that I saw who never laughed, which is not very exciting. It's a way of both saying, you know, I'm part of this tradition of transmitting information, but also the now of it is located near me, which feels very modern.
Yeah, it does. Putting himself in there, making sure that it's attributed to him, putting his own personal experience in there. It's something that I think we see kind of on the internet, but it's something that we don't necessarily perhaps see when we're talking about encyclopedias. So it's a cool place where these things come together.
That reminds me too, that like, it took me a really long time to get to this place, but at some point I started to ask, what kinds of things are people asking on modern encyclopedias that are online? What are they asking on Quora? What are they asking on Reddit? What does Wikipedia seek to answer? What unsaid questions are they seek to answer? What are people typing questions are they typing into their browser? And then also more vetted science sites like US government, if you want, vetted science sites. And I was surprised that they were asking the same questions and that sometimes the same answers were also offered that had to do with history, that had to do with science. And I felt like those gave me some insight into what Trevisa and his contemporaries were also doing. They're another mode of both popularizing and vernacularizing a discourse.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. You've drawn these parallels, which I think are so true and that maybe fly under the radar in some ways, where you're talking about some of the ways where you're explaining things like measurement. You're using ways that speak to people maybe on a smaller scale. Like I think you mentioned these days, we might be talking about the distance from the earth to the moon by how many basketballs that is. But that same type of comparison is something that we see in medieval literature, especially Trevisa's translation as well. So can you tell us a little bit about how that worked both back in the day and how it's working today?
Well, it's funny because my science background is really poor. And it's so poor that I wasn't even sure what the so-called right answers were to some of the information that's being passed on through Trevisa from encyclopedias like Bartholomus Anglicus's On the Properties of Things, which was a big staple encyclopedia from the 13th through the 16th century. It was a big Latin landmark encyclopedia. I wasn't even sure sometimes how to evaluate the information that was in there because I felt like I didn't know what the scientifically correct answer was. History, I felt like I knew how to look up. Science, not so sure. I felt like the book needed a further investigation to the larger scene of encyclopedias. And so I sort of went back in time and went from the 1240s, 1250s, 1260s, and started to explore a lot of the encyclopedias that are produced then that we would say would our natural history. Image du Monde, Thomas of Canterbury's De Natura Rerum, the Book of Sidrac. All of these are not, you know, very well known by people who study English and French literature, although they're known well by people who study medieval history of science. But a lot of these are constructed around possible questions that people might have around about the natural world. And so, for example, why is the sea salty? And I really didn't know like why the sea was salty. And not knowing why the sea was salty left me really open to what the possible answers were. That's a very, very common question on modern online, quote unquote, encyclopedias. Another question, as you refer to, are questions about relative size or relative smoothness. How long would it take to drive around the earth, which is not actually possible. So like those are interesting sort of questions because they kind of stretch the imagination. And also it helped me to see why I thought the medieval answers sounded scientific, or like, what is it about encyclopedias that make them sound right, make you feel like you're getting the right answer? They have to deliver information in a way that makes you feel like they're telling you the right thing. And that's true in modern encyclopedia is like Quora and Reddit too. Like people like the best answers. What's the best answer? Well, the best answer is partly what sounds the most convincing because you're using a certain kind of language. I think your original question was, how do I make modern encyclopedias and medieval encyclopedias illuminate each other? Well, one of them is coming from a place of ignorance and trying to figure out why some answers and some questions like are more scientific than others, and realizing that what we think sounds scientific, which also has a bit of like the rhetorical and the emotional to it, imaginative, comes from these medieval encyclopedias. They've actually like conditioned us to know when a question sounds scientific.
It's true. And this is what I'm talking about with why I'm so impressed by the book, is this close reading, this asking questions like what makes it sound scientific? I think that is what is brilliant about the book. And speaking of conditioning, one of the parts I most enjoyed about this book was you're talking about the index, because indexes, they have to start somewhere. Indexes didn't just, you know, fall from the heavens one day. People had to invent them. And so can you tell us a little bit about the index, how that kind of developed, but then like how Trevisa totally blows that up in ways that I think are super fun?
Yeah. So I had a really hard time reading Trevisa's Polychronicon in the Rolls series edition. It was really hard to read. So then I was like, okay, I'm going to do this trip. And part of the problem for someone like me is getting to my archives frequently enough. But I had some luxury of time in the British Library looking at Trevisa manuscripts. And I saw that they had an index. And I realized, you know, it was kind of fun to look up stuff using Trevisa's index. It was so terrible. It was like the worst index you've ever seen. It's hard to describe this orally. But he's basically conflated what we think of as an alphabetical index and a table of contents. So every alphabetical letter starts over with the like beginning and goes to the end of the Polychronicon, which is a really impractical way of looking things up. And he also is determined to use English letters. So W and Thorn and Yug, and they don't work that well for an index. He was really trying to create an English index that would be useful and interesting. And he created a really bad index. But I realized that using his bad index made me, first of all, appreciate the literary qualities, some of the more exciting places in the Polychronicon, in a way that if you used a conventional traditional index, you would never get to. I say that he's created a kind of tabloid index that gets you to like the really saucy bits and stuff. But I also realized that I didn't remember having ever seen an English index before Trevisa that wasn't like a personal index. So medieval scholars created indexes that could be copied and would be useful for a lot of different people in Latin. They also created indexes that would be useful just for them. So there's a lot of manuscripts where someone's like created like a small scrappy index just for that person, but it wouldn't work for like anyone else if you were to copy it. So this seems to me to be the first index that people really put an effort into to copy exactly and be circulated. So that was really fascinating to me.
Yeah, I like what you said about it being like a tabloid index, because we might be looking for something like A, King Arthur, or like E, King Edgar. But the one for King Edgar is under H, I think, for how do you like that hunting? It's like, what? And of course, you look at that and you're like, I immediately want to know what this story is.
Right. But you would never look it up under how, or it's like random women who are admonishing kings or private parts or like all kinds of stuff. Just to give you an idea of how not thought out this is, if you're looking up the Dead Sea in a Latin index, and one of the things that I realized are modern indexes are Latin indexes, just very, very barely anglicized, but they're basically Latin indexes. If you looked up the Dead Sea, you would look under C or possibly dead, usually C, comma, dead with a list of C, but maybe under D, maybe under M for mortuous. But instead, the Dead Sea is under Q, for quick thing doesn't sink in the Dead Sea, quick being an archaic word meaning alive, like the quick and the dead, or I bite my fingernails to the quick. But you would never look for the Dead Sea under quick, which means live. Like it's like the opposite. So anyway, so I found that really funny. And I also found it like really sort of dear, not to be patronizing to Trevisa in any way, but I just felt like it was so experimental and it like offered up so many possibilities. And I feel like our indexes are so boring, you know, they're about famous people, famous places, famous events, heavy on wars, heavy on like abstract nouns and virtues and vices and qualities. And his index was really about odd bodies and strange happenings. There's a lot more women in his index than there are in a normal index. So I feel like he offered almost an escape valve from the index. Like it could have been a really different kind of thing than it turned out to be. So,
yeah, well, I mean, it brings up the question, as you do in the book, what is the index for? What is it for? And most of the time, it's you just need to find that page where you find that famous person. But with Trevisa's super cool index, you get interested in what is actually in the book. So it's actually a way of kind of making the reader captivated or hooking them, which is not something I ever expected an index would do.
I know. If I was like a more creative person, I would have, for my own index for John Trevisa's Information Age, had a much more experimental index. But I wimped out and I just said a really conventional one. And I kind of hated myself for it.
The publisher probably wouldn't thank you for that, but at least you have, you know, indexes in the appendix so people can look at them.
Yeah, which was really, really hard to edit.
Yeah, I bet. And what's funny too about what you're saying about Trevisa's index is that when Caxton decided he was going to reissue this, he redid the index and he took out all the Middle English letters, didn't he?
Yeah, he wanted to sober up the whole enterprise. You know, I think he felt really like unpleasantly challenged by Trevisa's model of what informational English could look like and really wanted to rethink that. One for the ages. But I mean, he didn't entirely, because Trevisa's encyclopedia was transmitted into the post-medieval period. And so a lot of his descriptive language, if not his index, still comes down to us. And I think if I could have let myself gone on, I might have tried to come up with a chapter that pulled us even further towards the modern period, you know, tried to trace some of that informational prose and see where it ended up and connect all the dots. But I felt like that would be like a decade. So I didn't. I just closed it up.
That might be a lot of work. But as we wrap up, you're talking about descriptive language and stuff. Why should people know about Trevisa? Because you make a good argument for his name being one that we should know, especially literary scholars. Why should we know about Trevisa?
There's a couple different reasons. I think one thing is that Trevisa, you know, offers this alternative literary history to a Chaucerian history, so that Chaucer is translating Italian, French into the English vernacular and creating a robust English poetry. Chaucer also translated into prose, but I think anybody who compared Chaucer and Trevisa on the score would agree that Trevisa has the much more nimble and imaginative prose. I think that with Trevisa kind of forces us to look at the translation of literary English from a different perspective and parallel root, also from French and Latin traditions into the English vernacular, but by way of information. And once you decide that that is a literary root, then you realize that a lot of what we take to be literary characteristics, the way that literature is supposed to achieve like certain effects or to draw on emotions to be effective, are actually coming from informational prose. So the way that Trevisa offers an alternative narrative to Chaucer through his translation of information, but also the way that he makes us rethink where all the characteristics of what we call the literary come from are really important reasons to read him. I think one of the reasons that we don't read him as much is that we don't know how to read prose. And obviously, there are really great prose writers in English that we study, like Richard Rolla or Julian of Norwich, Marjorie Kemp. They're all like really interesting prose stylists, certainly the Wycliffeite Bible. But we tend not to teach our students or ourselves how to read medieval prose in the way we do with medieval verse. And we don't have a language for it the way that we do for like the novel. And I think one of the things that Trevisa does is sort of teach us how to read prose. He's acutely aware that he's made this decision to write in prose and that he's cultivating a very particular style.
Yeah, I think that's right on. It's just something that maybe is not considered because you're like, oh, this is an encyclopedia, therefore it's informational, therefore we don't need to look at it in terms of style. And I think that this book is going to change that. I think that people are going to read it and think, well, we really need to look at the literature behind this, the literary style behind this. So it's a great book. I really enjoyed it. And I'm so happy to have had you on the podcast. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
To find out more about Emily's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Piers at Penn. That's PIERSATPENN. Or you can visit her website at english.upenn.edu/people/Emily-Steiner. Her new book is John Trevisa's Information Age, Knowledge and the Pursuit of Literature, circa 1400. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up this week, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, this week we've got a very popular piece. It's from Lucy Lamagne, and it's on the 5 most common jobs in a medieval city. And so she went to research the French city of Montpellier, looked at her local tax records, and there's thousands of people that have their list of their occupations. So she's able to kind of give us a top 5 list. So that's pretty cool. We've also got Tang Tomb Guardians and a Netflix for people who love churches.
A Netflix for people who love churches. Wow.
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So if you're interested in looking at churches and medieval churches in particular, there's something to keep you binging.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing. Oh, speaking of Netflix for history nerds, I should probably mention that I had a guest spot on History Hit's Gone Medieval podcast that came out on Saturday. So if people want to check that out, they can check that out too. I'm just talking about monks again.
I did. It was pretty good. It's good to share in the podcast.
Yeah, share the love. All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your support each month. We have great stuff for patrons like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. All of these things might make pretty awesome gifts for a medieval lover. I'm just saying. To get in on all the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. As I mentioned last week, if you've been waiting for my new book, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, to come out, but you haven't grabbed a copy yet, or you want another copy for friends and family, you are in luck. My publisher, Abbeville Press, has a special offer just for my favorite people, and that includes you, of 20% off if you order it directly from their website. Just go to abbeville.com, look up How to Live Like a Monk, and use the code Benedict, as in Saint Benedict, to get 20% off the cover price as a special gift from me to you. We'll also have the link in the show notes on medievalist.net. Thanks for supporting me and the book. For everything from Compendia to Constantine, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sobolski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which is now out in North America and very soon in the UK. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.